Welcome, everybody, to this Wellington College Education podcast. And it is an enormous pleasure and privilege to have Major General James Cowan as our guest tonight, and or whichever part of the world you are in, to join us. And James is a completely remarkable figure, having risen right up the army and then switched career, as you will hear him say, from it's not a total switch from the military to his career of the last 10 years, which is involved in this extraordinary organization, HALO, and working to bring peace. And the connections between war and peace are just some of the questions that we'll be looking at. So, James, let's begin with perhaps the first moment that HALO hit global consciousness, obviously before you joined, when Princess Diana wore that HALO top and became involved in landmines. So how did that all that come about?
Well, hello, Anthony. Nice to talk to you. Thank you so much for asking me on the pod. Diana, Princess of Wales, went to Angola in the new year of 1997. And she was actually on a visit to the International Committee of the Red Cross. But she was aware of the landmine problem and asked to come and visit a minefield. And she came to Wambo, which is in the center of the country. And Angola was at that point still recovering from conflict. In fact, the conflict would restart after she left. And it had been the scene of a very messy, very difficult war, not only a war of independence from Portugal, but a civil war in which then various external parties, including the Cubans, the North Koreans, and the South Africans intervened. And Wambo was the center of much of that fighting. And she walked through a cleared minefield. Some people think she walked through a live minefield. That would not have been a good idea. The photograph that comes from it is pretty iconic. Anyway, I was back in Angola last week, this time with Prince Harry. And Prince Harry has visited Angola a couple of times. And he went back to what remains the largest minefield in Africa. It's 27 miles long. He was there last in 2013 at this particular minefield. And he walked through another section of it. Much as his mother had done before. I think it was pretty moving for him to be there. But this huge minefield that we've been slowly chipping away at is gradually passing into history. And the whole point about what we do is that we can take a country from the most difficult moment of a post-conflict situation to one where it is at peace. And Angola is now at peace. It is very proud of the fact that it's put its past behind it. And in fact, it's now exporting some of its ideas about peace building to the rest of the region. Other countries are less settled or more troubled, the Democratic Republic of Congo being a good example. And Angola is playing a very responsible role in promoting peace and stability in the region. So it was a very uplifting visit. And I got back on Friday and but my work now takes me across the world to countries as different as Ukraine and Southeast Asia. So there we are.
As we will come on and explore, just before we come back in time, the Harry visit, what does Harry bring to HALO? And does he still have some of the magic? Does he have some of the magic that Diana had in terms of raising awareness of HALO's work and indeed of landmines?
He absolutely does have that. And he's a very engaging individual. He's a very instinctive character. And it was fun just to be around him for a few days. Of course, he's not a working royal. And so he's not our royal patron, but he is a very active supporter of what we do. His passion is not only in the clearance of landmines, but it is about the work of conservation organizations and the very real link between the conflict that took place in Angola and the terrible damage to the natural environment that has resulted. And so he's very engaged in helping rebuild Angola's natural environment as well. So he's been a great supporter of HALO.
Let's come back to all the way back to your time at Wellington, because this is predominantly a Wellington audience. And how was it, James, that you pitched up on the fair shore of Crowthorne? What was happening there in your life?
Well, I'm probably no different from most other boys turning up at Wellington in at that time, which is that it wasn't my decision. You know, you're a child, you're a 13-year-old, and you get told where you're going. My father's family were Etonians, but my grandfather was a slightly sort of rebellious character, and he's probably in a small group of old Etonians to become a British Rail signalman. And so he
was unusual, a bit niche.
So he wasn't. So my father was actually educated in America. And then my mother's family were Wellingtonians. And my two uncles had been at Wellington, and my cousins remain very, very keen supporters of Wellington, the Spurling family. And their children were also at Wellington. So it's been a very big part of my life, I suppose. And I don't think I was a particularly good Wellingtonian in the sense that I'm absolutely terrible at sport. And it was only really in the sixth form, I think, that I began to thrive. But that's for a different bit of the story, maybe.
Well, you'll be relieved to know that I have not, when preparing for this, looked back over your school reports, James. So I'm not going to be suddenly revealing anything about your geography report in year 10 or anything. But much more interesting is, was it at the time that you were there much more of a military school? And when did you realise that you wanted to have a career in the military?
I don't think it was a particularly military school. I mean, we're talking about the late 1970s now, and I think you know, people at Wellington were far less interested in the military than they were in sort of Led Zeppelin or AC/DC.
Which, by the way, to younger listeners, are rock bands.
Indeed. And so very few people really thought about the military. And I suppose I did because I was quite influenced by my grandfather, who had soldiered during the Second World War, had later done a lot of writing and thinking about war. And I suppose that interested me. So but I think I was different from many people joining the army simply because it was something to do between school and retiring. I was interested in soldiering as a profession.
And you then went up to university and came across two remarkable people who broadened your thinking about strategic thinking. Tell us about that.
Well, Sir Michael Howard, not the Michael Howard of politics, but of academia, had served in the Coldstream Guards in the war and had become Britain at that time, Britain's leading military historian and academic, and written extensively on people like Clausewitz. He was a big influence on me. And my tutor in my college was another Wellingtonian called Piers Mackesy. Piers was the son of the British general who fought rather unsuccessfully in Norway in the early part of the war. But he again was an influence on me. And I very much enjoyed being taught by them. I might add, just to drop in another name from Wellington, the guy who really switched me on to learning and thinking was Howard Tomlinson. Now, he wasn't a military historian. In fact, I think the last thing on his mind was military history. But he really inspired me at Wellington. And I think he's the reason why I went to Oxford and gave me a lifelong interest in learning.
Just interesting to reflect there that Wellington has made a very significant impact on the formation of thought about military thinking, military strategy, never more so than in the great historian Michael Howard, who Max Hastings, the well-known Telegraph editor, Spectator editor, and a military historian, was his greatest influence as well. James, in the military, you served. Let's pick out Kosovo to begin with, and before we go on and talk about Iraq and Afghanistan, Kosovo. Can you tell us about your own work there, and why was the British involvement successful in Kosovo in the 1990s compared in the early 21st century to Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I think there were a couple of ingredients that made the Kosovo operation a success. The first is that the United Kingdom still had some degree of self-confidence. It had fought some wars, the Falklands, the First Gulf War, and it had delivered successfully on these. It had also brought the Northern Ireland troubles to a successful conclusion with the Good Friday Agreement. And it was used, it had a track record of succeeding, and therefore it was confident in that success. The second thing is that the new Blair government had a leader who himself saw things in a more visionary way. And whilst there had been quite a lot of procrastination in the context of Bosnia, Blair quickly saw what needed to be done. So he then showed that leadership, galvanized not only European support for what was needed, but he persuaded President Clinton to take part. And as a young officer with responsibility for Kosovo in the Ministry of Defence, I found myself catapulted into that world of really offering advice at the most senior levels of planning for an operation that initially was conceived as an air campaign, but later had the threat of a full-scale land invasion behind it to make Milosevic come to heel.
And what was it about Kosovo and that whole region that sparked Tony Blair's interest and engaged him emotionally as well as intellectually?
Well, the Balkans, as we all know, had been very difficult for most of the 1990s, the breakup of Yugoslavia, the arguable mishandling of the Bosnia War meant that he really didn't want to repeat that mistake. I also think he had good military advice, and the then Chief of the Defence Staff, Charles Guthrie, had formed this really fantastic relationship with him, and the two were in each other's minds and trusted each other. And I think that was very important. I think he also cared deeply about the fate of the Albanian Kosovars, who were being ethnically cleansed and forced over the border. And so it wasn't just a question of realpolitik. There was a moral underpinning to what he chose to do.
So what then, can you describe the situation on the ground, and how did things deteriorate following the relative stability of the creation of Yugoslavia after the Second World War, the death of its omnipotent leader Tito, and how it all broke up, and how the tensions that had been suppressed for so long bubbled up to the surface?
Well, the bulk of the former Yugoslavia, of course, was Christian, either Orthodox or Catholic. But there were two significant Muslim minorities, the first in Bosnia, the Bosniak population there, and secondly, Albanian Kosovars. And Kosovo had been treated less as one of the constituent states that made up the federal entity of Yugoslavia, but as basically a province, a colony of Serbia. And they were treated very much as second-class citizens. And the great battle of Serbian history, the Battle of Kosovo Polja, Kosovo Field, you know, meant that the Serbs did not in any way view Kosovo as a potential separate state. Far from it, they wished to suppress it and retain it within Serbia. So that tension really was at the root cause of what took place. And the appalling treatment of the Kosovars at that time is really the impulse that drove Blair and the rest of the West to take action.
And how did that action unfold, James? And your involvement?
Yes. So my particular involvement at first was a fairly unstable ceasefire and a thing called the Kosovo verification mission. And once it was clear that Milosevic was not going to honour that, then an air campaign began. And air power has a coercive aspect to it. But what it can't ultimately do is change the situation on the ground. And despite the use of air power as a tool that perhaps avoids boots on the ground, as the weeks went on and the target list began to reduce, because ultimately there's only so many bridges and barracks you can blow up, it was apparent that a ground invasion might be necessary. And what was so interesting, I think, at that time was that the British military could still put troops at large scale onto the ground. And there was a confidence there and an ability to act that has since eroded. But Blair offered up a force of 50,000 British troops within an invasion force of 200,000, 100,000 of whom would have been American and 50,000 probably mostly French. And that was a pretty, you know, confident strategic decision by him. In the event, it wasn't necessary because the threat of it forced Milosevic to cave in.
And just tell those people who are not aware of Milosevic's character, who he was, what kind of person was he?
Well, after the fall of Tito, and Tito had been very astute at keeping all the different elements of Yugoslavia together, a far more statesmanlike character than Milosevic. Milosevic was at heart a gangster, a Serb to the tips of his toes, and instinctively not able to conduct that kind of federal statesman-like role that Tito had done. So he acted solely in the interest of Serbia, and the results were the destruction of Yugoslavia that he presided over.
And how did it all finish, and what was the importance of the British contribution to that?
Well, famously, Clinton reluctantly acceded to Blair's advice, and the Americans became engaged. Milosevic, when he realized that a ground invasion was looming, caved in, and in went the NATO troops from Macedonia, led by a British general, Mike Jackson. There were moments, because I remember distinctly that the moment when we learnt that the Russian peacekeeping force in Bosnia was heading eastwards towards Kosovo to occupy Pristina airfield before General Jackson could get there. And I remember the discussions very, very clearly in which the American commander, General Wes Clark, ordered General Jackson to get there before the Russians arrived. And we had to make some quick decisions. And it seemed to me, and this is where I think junior advice can occasionally be helpful. I remember going to see General Guthrie and saying to him, I don't think you should do this. First of all, the airfield is strategically irrelevant. Secondly, the chances of British troops being accidentally shot down as they flew in helicopters are quite high. And third, do we really need a confrontation with Russia at a time when relations with Putin weren't too bad? And General Guthrie, I think, already knew that in his own mind. He didn't need my advice particularly. But General Jackson famously then turned to General Clark and said, I'm not starting the Third World War for you, General. And so a little bit of Nelsonic turning of the blind eye meant that a direct confrontation with Russia was avoided.
And General Mike Jackson, of course, to mention in passing, was another old Wellingtonian. Now, why, James, was British action in Kosovo at the end of the 20th century, the 1990s, successful, but actions in the beginning of the 21st century in Afghanistan and Iraq, less so or not at all, depending on one's viewpoint? Let's take Iraq first, and filling in for the younger viewers who will be less aware of what actually how the Iraq war began and started.
So there's a, you know, the two Greek words, hubris and nemesis, spring to mind in this context. Britain had, as I said, had this track record of succeeding. The Falklands, the First Gulf War, the Northern Ireland process, the end of the Cold War, and now Kosovo. It seemed as if anything we did would always succeed. And I think some of that hubris led to some of the lack of very rigorous thinking about Iraq. And of course, it is in fact the Afghan crisis that precedes Iraq, because it took that took place with 9/11. And there was a very clear moral and strategic reason for taking action over over al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. But quite quickly, the West was distracted by the US administration's decision to include Iraq within this global war on terror, when in fact the Saddam Hussein regime was not in any way aligned with al-Qaeda. And so decisions were taken that really were not necessarily in anyone's best interests.
And what do we now know, James, 22 years on, about those fateful decisions in March 2003? Why? What was the obsession in the mind of the American president and the team around him with Iraq when, as you say, Afghanistan was being contained after 9/11, and this was a mighty distraction, and that wasn't the least of the problems with invading Iraq.
I think
why?
That,
why?
Yeah, well, it's some very good questions. Well, one of the ironies at the heart of this is the miscalculation made by Saddam Hussein himself. In order to what he believed was to achieve a deterrent effect, he lied about his possession of weapons of mass destruction. He pretended he had them when, in fact, he didn't. And the West believed that he did. I don't have any truck with those who think that the West was lying about the intelligence. I'm very confident from my own knowledge of the time that we in the West genuinely believed they had these weapons. Of course, in hindsight, we know they didn't. So that was one major reason. The second reason, I think, was about more geostrategic reasoning around creating a bulwark against Iran, that if Iraq could be turned into a Western-leaning and Western-supporting nation, then Iran could be contained. And the third reason, I think, was economic. Certainly, you know, why not, after all these years of a very patchy oil exports from Iraq, why not have it as a thriving oil economy playing its part within the global economic structure?
Where did it go wrong? Strategy or execution or lack of an end plan, game plan, or a mixture of all three?
So my view is slightly perhaps countercultural. I believe most wars start chaotically, go through difficult phases before particularly Western democracies get into gear. It's true of Britain in the Second World War. It's true of Britain in the First World War. It's true of Britain in the Napoleonic Wars and Revolution. It takes time. And it was chaotic to start with, and many, many mistakes were made. They're all on record. The disbandment of the Iraqi army, the abolition of the Ba'ath Party, all these things were bad mistakes. But the biggest mistake, in my view, and this is countercultural, is that we left. We had an obsession with exit strategies at the very point at which, after all those years of making mistakes, we'd actually got our act together, we chose to leave. We being the new Obama administration and the sort of the fag end of the Blair Brown years, when their confidence was so sapped by the criticism, political criticism they'd received, we gave up. We gave up and we left it as a highly sectarian society in which the Shia then exacted revenge on the Sunnis and led directly to the rise of ISIS. And that was a gross strategic error, a gross act of irresponsibility by the West. Yes, we made early mistakes, but we should have stuck with Iraq and it turned it into a much better society. Ironically, it is now emerging from that age, and there are some actually quite promising signs in Iraq here in 2025.
Was the decision to invade, just to get clear of your views, was that the right or the wrong decision?
I think in hindsight, it was the wrong decision. If we had left Saddam Hussein in office, he would probably have fallen during the Arab Spring. But having decided to invade for what were at that time seemingly logical reasons associated with his possession of weapons of mass destruction, we should have seen it through.
The impact on Tony Blair, who was being set up and building towards being a really extraordinary prime minister with, as you say there, James, the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland and Kosovo, and coming at the end of a whole series of British successful uses of force and power. It then all went wrong in the latter years. How significant do you think was Iraq in tarnishing his image and restricting his confidence and power?
I think it did have a huge impact. It is a massive blot on his legacy as a prime minister. But I take, again, a slightly countercultural view. I think that he had the political courage to be a friend and ally of someone who was not a natural political bedfellow in the form of George W. Bush. And he served a UK national interest by maintaining that relationship. I think, as I say, his mistake was to lose confidence towards the end, because if he had stuck with it, Iraq would have been not a failure, but a success story. I still think he is the best prime minister we've had for a very long time. I mean, he's ironically 10 years younger than either of the most recent American presidents. I think what he does nowadays with the Tony Blair Institute is terrific stuff. And I think he still is a huge force for good in the world. He's a loss to our country. And the what followed in the conservative years and coalition years of quite patchy, difficult relations with the Americans, I do think that Keir Starmer is not doing a bad job at all in terms of forging a similar relationship. But all of us could learn a thing or two from how the Blair government managed that relationship with our principal ally.
In terms of Britain's own self-confidence and standing in the world and economic position thereafter, it was a case of never glad, confident warning again after Iraq and the aftermath. And Britain, I think it's important for younger listeners to recognise, has nothing like the self-confidence that it had in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher or under the Blair years at the highlight. Let's switch over to Afghanistan. And if the mistake in Iraq was to quit too early when the gains were beginning to be felt, did the West stay too long in Afghanistan? And what was the end game?
Yeah.
Did the West have to leave when it did?
No, it didn't, and it should have remained engaged. And the collapse of the regime, the fall of Kabul, was a genuinely seismic and shocking moment. The West had invested upwards of $2 trillion in Afghanistan. It spent money wildly, often badly, but it delivered some good things. If you look at Afghanistan today, I was only there 3 weeks ago. Kabul is a thriving, huge metropolis. It's a country with a vast population of young people, burgeoning youth. It is a country that is vital to the stability of our world, and if you ignore it, you ignore it at your peril. We need to be much more engaged in how we forge a stable, responsible Afghanistan into the future. But the manner of our leaving was reprehensible and could have been avoided.
And that came, of course, in the first year of the first Donald Trump presidency, in the summer of 2021. Why was it, James, that a man you've mentioned once already was able to exploit the circumstances of the 21st century much more intently, despite having a much smaller economic base in his country than other leaders, namely Vladimir Putin? What was it that Putin was doing with the comparatively economically unimportant Russia? How was he able to leverage the resources he did have more successfully and more confidently than American presidents were in the 10s and 20s, in the noughties and 10s rather, and or indeed than Europe?
Well, I have a substantial program in Ukraine at the moment, and so I've been tracking...
Which we'll come on to in a moment.
But previously, as a British soldier, I was engaged with helping the Ukrainian military reform and make itself fit for purpose. I think that, you know, this is I have nothing much to add that is not already widely known, but it is a well-acknowledged reality that Vladimir Putin began his time in office as someone who was relatively friendly to the West, the first person to ring George W. Bush after 9/11, after the Twin Towers, was not Tony Blair, but Vladimir Putin. But he had within him both a capacity to reach out to Western leaders and to interact with them successfully, but also underneath a deep-seated anger, bitterness, resentment at what he saw as the split of the breakup of the Soviet Empire, and a belief that Russia's destiny as a great power had been thwarted by NATO. Now, I don't think he was right on that account, but he has essentially been consistent in his pursuit of that goal of reuniting the Russian Empire. If you look at each of the wars that preceded Ukraine in Chechnya and Georgia, you can see the very much the same game book being deployed, and to what actually has happened in Ukraine. So he has a consistency of behavior that we should take close notice of.
Let's look at your own switch in early 2015 to Halo. And why did you make that decision? You were then a major general. You could have carried on going up and up. What was the state of Halo? We talked about it, obviously, under Princess Diana 15 more years before. What was the state of it when you came into it?
So, I left the army largely because I had enjoyed what I'd done. But my wife is a doctor, and she was working very hard at the time, and the army wanted me to go back to Afghanistan for a year. And I with children at school and a wife working full time, I felt I needed something different. And I also wanted to leave young enough. I was 51 when I left the army 10 years ago. And I thought that if I stayed on to do a full career, it'd be quite hard to go into a second career. So that was my private reasoning. But what I inherited in Halo was a fantastic organization. It was small. It was a sort of a weird alliance of humanitarians and military misfits. It was dealing with what I would describe as the niche question of landmines, which are prolific in this world, but it is a particular niche area. And it was very good at that, but it was a sort of well-kept secret. Nobody really heard of it other than the Princess Diana moment. And I thought I could turn this into something that is actually central to one of the big questions of our age. And that question, I think, is conflict, which I think is becoming increasingly dominant and decreasingly well understood.
Can you, before we talk about those, just give us a brief survey, James, of landmines? When did that, what is the landmine, and when did it first enter warfare, and how do they work? How's the technology of landmines changed? Why are they so deadly and difficult to deal with?
Well, mines have been part of warfare since the invention of gunpowder. And, you know, in a medieval siege, you would build a tunnel under the castle walls and fill it with gunpowder, blow it up and watch the wall drop. But really, landmines, as you and I understand them, didn't really feature in the First World War. But in the Second World War, they were used prolifically, and they are an essentially defensive weapon. And what makes them especially evil is that they're put in the ground to kill or maim a soldier. But because they are indiscriminate and dumb munitions, in fact, what they will do is remain the eternal vigilant sentry in the ground, not just for years, but decades, perhaps even centuries after the event, because they're made of plastic. And they won't be killing soldiers at that point. They'll be killing and maiming civilians, often children. And not only will they be harming people from a humanitarian perspective, from a developmental perspective, they are a huge inhibitor to a country, you know, farming its land, building industry, building roads. They have a very, very damaging impact on the broader developmental possibilities of any country.
And have they got more difficult to detect even decades afterwards? And do they become more or less likely to detonate with the passage of time?
So they have become harder to detect because people have invested in low metal or no metal contact technology. So it's essentially a hermetically sealed plastic box in which there's almost no trace of metal. So metal detectors don't always work. So, but the good news is lots of technology is emerging. Magnetic resonance technology out of the Australian other mining industry, the extractive industry, finding trace gold in a huge bank of rock. We've been able to translate that into some of our detection capability. We're very excited by the possibilities of artificial intelligence. We're using wide area surveillance because some of the minefields, let's take Ukraine, it's 1,000 kilometers long, the front line, and being able to invest in drone technology, satellite technology, imagery, and AI, we can absolutely finesse where the landmine contamination is and save billions in so doing. So yes, technology is absolutely taking leaps and bounds forward, and this will massively increase the speed of clearance away from hands and knees, old-fashioned demining, and moving towards mechanization and tech in the round.
And do those laying the minefields, James, keep detailed records of where the mines are? And roughly speaking, how many undetected mines, landmines, are there in the world, in Europe today? Let's narrow it to Europe, including Ukraine.
It is hard to know exactly how many mines there are left in the world. It's a bit like saying how much gold is left in the ground. It is an inherently unknowable thing. But I was in, as I might have mentioned, in Angola last week. And whilst we were there, Prince Harry was shown some mine maps. And these were mine maps that meant under the Geneva Convention to be made available by any party to a conflict. But in fact, they'd been lost, and we had been able to trace back to the original South African unit who'd laid those mines. And we were able to show Prince Harry the actual sketches that the South African soldiers had made. So that's quite exciting. But I'm afraid the Geneva Conventions are not well followed. And although detailed records are meant to be kept, very often they're not. The other reason, of course, is that many people who lay landmines are not state actors. They're non-state actors like the Taliban or ISIS. So there is a very major problem in terms of surveying the land to find the explosive contamination.
And just to ask a question there about drones, which is such a feature of the Ukraine war, are they providing HALO with fresh challenges if a drone is with explosives is downed and not detonated, or is that something you haven't got on your horizon yet?
No, it's very much on our horizon. And one of the problems is that the Russians have developed drones with fiber optic cables. Until a few months ago, the Ukraine war was a kind of 10-kilometer death strip in which really it was impossible for either side to do much within that 10 kilometers. But increasingly, the range of these Russian drones is extending, and these fiber optic cables mean they can't be jammed as easily. So they can reach 60, 70, 80 kilometers behind the front line, which makes us vulnerable. So this is a big issue for us. And there is also the sad reality. My people in Ukraine work incredibly hard in the daytime, but they're also constantly under attack at night from these Shahid drones. There's only 2 weekends ago that 700 Shahid drones dropped on Ukraine during the whole of the war. For comparative reasons, only 2,400 V1 bombers were dropped on London, but 700 in one night. And each of these drones is about the same size as a V1 bomber. So no sleep, constant air raids, constant moving to take shelter. It's a deeply grinding experience, and there's no end in sight for some really brave people who are dealing with this day after day. And really, the prospect of peace is nowhere in sight.
And we know that the First World War, those involved in bombshell disposal are still periodically being killed from ordnance left behind from that war more than 100 years ago. Does HALO lose many people, or how dangerous is it for your staff?
So we employ, it depends on the moment, but between 10 and 12,000 people around the world, which is a huge number. And we take huge care, in fact, huge pride, actually, in the quality of the training we give them. And the safety standards we set is absolutely vital. And we're very fortunate that we don't have too many casualties. In Ukraine, sadly, we have lost 2 people last year, but they are the exception. And we've been operating in Ukraine since 2015. So we're very, very committed to the highest possible safety standards. One of the problems of landmine clearance is at the start of a conflict, cowboy outfits get set up who don't offer good training, and very often casualties arise. Of course, there is the flip side to that, which is if we didn't clear these devices quickly, then civilians will be harmed. So there is a need for safety, but there is also a need for speed.
And the last question before we come through to questions from those watching is your work and HALO's work on conflict resolution, and are the forces of compassion and light moving more quickly than the forces of darkness and maestros of AI and landmine technologies in devising systems which are ever more deadly? Who is moving more quickly?
Yes,
who will prevail?
Well, I'm an optimist, and ultimately I'm sure that those who believe in peace will prevail. But I am disturbed by Britain. I'm an ex-soldier. Of course, I favour investment in defence, and I'm glad that we are improving our, parlous military state. But to do so at the expense of our conflict prevention work is a terrible mistake. And Britain really needs to understand what an error it is making, but also to actually understand just how affordable our work is. I mean, to give one example, we are funded by the British to about 2 million every year in Afghanistan, and about 4 million people are living on land cleared by HALO. That's 4 million people not migrating to this country. The British spend about £8 million a day on hotels to house refugees. Every day they're spending that much money. So a tiny amount of money is making a massive difference upstream, and yet we're putting all our money into downstream work, which is frankly pointless in a hotel somewhere in Brighton. And I think Britain really needs to think much more strategically about this. So I am an optimist, but you know, some of our behaviours could lead you to be more pessimistic.
Right. Well, thank you very much indeed for that wonderful horizon tour of so much of your own career, James, and the history of conflict in the last 30, 40 years. Coming through to questions, does HALO, you've answered this a bit already, but deal with other weapons and munitions and IEDs and so on? How has the work of HALO become more sophisticated in dealing with more sophisticated weaponry?
Yeah, the answer is yes, we do. And we took a conscious shift into dealing with IEDs in 2018. Much of our work now in Afghanistan, but also in the Middle East, in countries like Syria and Iraq, is about tackling IEDs. But
Can you just explain IEDs, by the way?
So, an IED is essentially a homemade landmine. It's an improvised explosive device. It's made, it's a cottage industry made, in someone's home or in a shed somewhere. It essentially involves either repurposing military grade explosives or homemade explosive. It has a pressure plate, usually a simple battery for initiation, highly effective and very, very cheap to produce. So IEDs are a massive problem and we're very much involved with that. Secondly, we're in places like Gaza, where the problem is not landmines or IEDs, it's a combination of artillery ammunition, air-delivered munitions and Hamas booby traps and tunnel systems. Very, very complex work in an urban environment. Massive humanitarian need. The same would be true of Syria. And of course, you're dealing then not only with the technical business, but also human populations shifting very rapidly, wanting to reoccupy their homes. The speed of which we work is absolutely vital. Third area is weapon control. And we have large-scale weapon control programs in Latin America, West Africa, the Balkans. You know, the world is awash with small arms and light weapons, many of which are badly controlled, flowing into the criminal underworld, flowing into drugs, flowing into terrorism. So we are part of a process of controlling those weapons, either by destroying them or accounting for them or building armories. Absolutely vital stuff.
Thank you. Question, how will the war in Ukraine resolve and when?
Well, I have no crystal ball, nor am I divine. So the straight answer is I don't know. But I can tell you this. My view is that it would be very difficult for either side to win in an old-fashioned sense of winning. The powers of defense vastly exceed the powers of offense. Entrenchment, drone technology, a very, very transparent battlefield means it's almost impossible to launch an offensive without suffering crippling losses. Ukraine cannot easily win this war, therefore. And I do think President Trump is right to talk about being realistic about war aims, and that if peace comes, it will have to involve some give and take on both sides. However, that implies that President Putin is willing to negotiate. And it seems to me everything that he has done in the last few months since President Trump came to office would indicate that he is not. He's playing it long. He's buying time. His behaviors are frankly dishonorable and I think that the West needs to apply considerable pressure to change that paradigm.
What would winning the war for Vladimir Zelensky and Ukraine look like? Clearing Russia totally out of all Ukraine territory?
Probably not. I think peace would involve concessions territorially. I'm not going to go into the detail of what territorial concessions, but in fact, Ukraine absolutely needs peace. It needs the chance to rebuild its shattered economy. In my particular area, 150,000 square kilometers of Ukrainian prime agricultural land is contaminated by landmines. Ukraine's economy.
Just use that figure again, James.
150,000 square kilometers is an absolutely vast figure. Now, that's the suspect area. Probably good survey will reduce it in size, but nevertheless, it means that huge areas of Ukraine are not being farmed at the moment. Ukraine needs to rebuild not only its agriculture, but its industry. And I think a reasonable peace involves some concessions on land. It involves security guarantees to Ukraine. It involves Ukraine's economy being helped back. It involves, if not EU membership, but certainly trade agreements with the European Union. And I think Ukraine, if it can achieve that, even if it loses some land, it will come out of this a far stronger, more dynamic, freer, positive society and economy than Russia will ever be.
Different but related question here on nuclear war. Has what's happened in the last couple of years in Ukraine and in Iran made nuclear war more or less likely?
These are the big questions. I think that
it's a big-minded audience.
It's a big-minded audience. I think, in fact, fears over nuclear escalation in the context of Ukraine are overstated. I think that, yes, President Putin does own tactical nuclear weapons, but
I'll just explain tactical nuclear weapons.
The West, Britain, for instance, doesn't have any tactical nuclear weapons. It believes in the concept of deterrence through the use of a strategic nuclear capability, which in the UK is met by nuclear armed submarines. But we don't believe in tactical nuclear weapons. And the Russians have them. And there is always the fear that a small artillery fired round, which would kill a small town, it would wipe out Prothorn, for instance. It would be a horrific event. Wouldn't really serve a battlefield benefit because you would then have severe contamination, which your conventional troops couldn't move into. But it would also lead to escalation and ultimately to a strategic exchange of intercontinental ballistic missiles. So that is the nightmare scenario of escalation through tactical to the strategic. I think that has always been overstated. Putin saber rattles, but I think he knows full well that to use a tactical nuclear weapon in the context of Ukraine would be absolutely catastrophic for him and his country. So I don't think it's going to happen. I do think that the question of Iran is really important. I think the decision taken by President Trump the other day was a very difficult one. Israel had started, and so therefore someone had to finish. And whether the destruction of Iran's nuclear capability has happened or not, in part or in full, only an intelligence agency can answer that. I certainly can't. But I think that having begun, it had to end. And I reluctantly think that President Trump took the right decision. What follows next, though, really matters. I mean, if Iran had got 60%, which vastly exceeds that necessary for the production of nuclear domestic energy, there can only have been one reason for reaching 60%. And so I do think that controlling Iran is important. What I would like to see, though, is a return to the negotiating table. And I would hope that pressure is applied to the Iranians to realize that if they don't, there will be further issues. So this is an unresolved question. Don't think it's ended here. The matter continues to be a live one, really, until the Iranian nuclear capability is controlled.
And the final question of all, James, it's a personal one. It is, who have been your, you mentioned some at one at school and two at university, who have been your influences that have shaped your own life? And if you hadn't lived the life you had, what else might you have done?
Oh, gosh. Well, funny enough, I'm someone who gets a lot of energy from being around younger people. And the joy of being in the Halo Trust is that we recruit some amazing people. And when you think of influencers, you're normally thinking of somebody older than you and wiser than you. Mm-hmm. But I like being around the young energy and talent that comes into the Halo Trust. It was a real pleasure to be in Angola last week with those same people. And we continue to recruit people like you, whoever's listening from the Wellington audience. I'm looking for people who seek adventure, who want to make a difference in this world, who don't want a humdrum job. You know, we are the natural destination for you if you're that sort of person. But as far as people who've influenced me, throughout my life, I mean, I think my wife is a massive influence on me, actually. That's a massive Good. Part of who I am. She's a doctor. She has different interests from me, which I think is always for the good. I think my friends, I every year we have a kind of walking weekend in Wales, and I go up there and we just have fun. We go and walk some part of the Black Mountains or Brecon Beacons. So having a wide friendship group beyond the normal, and my friends, some are ex-military, but many are from school or university. I mean, that's the thing that matters most. And my own family, you know, my children are young people now in their 20s. I love to see them and see them thrive in this world. So that's what really makes me function well. As to what I might have done, very hard to say, really. That sort of, you know, parallel universe. I could have done a number of different things, I suppose, but I do think I am ultimately driven by an interest in global affairs. Could I have been a diplomat, or as well as being a soldier and a humanitarian, something of that kind, I think, would have appealed.
Well, you've given an enormous and very rich tapestry of thoughts on such a wide area. James, thank you on behalf of the Wellington College Education community. Thank you very much indeed for the time you've given us. We've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony.